headlines.
I'm Ray Kugel reporting a new U.S. call on Turkey in the battle against Islamic State. U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter says Turkey needs to do more to fight Islamic State and control its borders. Secretary Carter says while Turkey's agreed in principle to join the U.S.-led airstrikes against the militants, it is only part of what's necessary.
I don't think they're dragging their feet. I think that they have, their leadership has indicated that this needs to be done. It's overdue because it's a year into the campaign, but they're indicating some considerable effort now, including some allowing us to use their airfields.
Secretary Carter says President Obama is part of the active discussions with Turkey to get more involved. With a new bailout in hand, Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras abruptly resigned Thursday, calling for a snap election on September 20th. It comes just 7 months after he took office. The resignation came in the face of a revolt among lawmakers from his ruling Syriza party, anger that he had failed to live up to his political campaign promises to end the austerity measures international creditors had forced Athens to accept in exchange for more bailout money. Burundi's President Pierre Nkurunziza was sworn in for a third term on Thursday, but remains under fire from critics who says he is breaking term limits in the Constitution. The U.S. State Department said the inauguration shows the crisis in Burundi is not over and that Mr. Nkurunziza may have trouble governing because of increasing violence and a declining economy. He took the oath of office in a surprise ceremony 6 days before the scheduled inauguration. This is VOA News. The United States is expressing concern about North Korea's artillery fire toward South Korea, which retaliated by firing its own artillery in their latest flare-up of cross-border violence. State Department spokesman John Kirby said Thursday that such provocative actions by the North only heightened tensions threatening regional peace and security. 4 people were killed and 11 injured Thursday when a bomb exploded near the governor's office in Aden in Yemen. The city was recently recaptured from Houthi militants by forces allied with the returning government in exile. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports.
The Aden governor was reportedly in the building but unharmed by the blast. As violence continues, even in a city declared liberated from militants early this month, as exiled government officials return to Yemen. The United Nations says Yemen's humanitarian crisis has become so severe that millions of people are at risk of famine. But some analysts say there is hope that peace talks will resume as coalition forces retake cities in the south. Heather Murdoch, Cairo.
An Islamic State-affiliated group claimed responsibility for a large car bombing outside a state security building in Cairo Thursday, wounding dozens. Local officials say at least 6 policemen were among those hurt by the massive blast in the residential neighborhood of Shubra. Former U.S. President Jimmy Carter says medical tests reveal he has melanoma, a form of cancer usually associated with the skin. Mr. Carter announced Thursday the disease spread from his liver to his brain.
I'll get my first radiation treatment for the melanoma in my brain this afternoon. And then I understand I'll have 4 treatments scheduled at 3-week intervals.
Former President Carter described himself as surprisingly at ease upon receiving the bad news. France and Britain have joined together to more closely tackle the migrant crisis. They signed an agreement establishing a joint command center in the French port city of Calais, where thousands try to cross over to Britain illegally. Lisa Bryant has more.
London says it will increase manpower and funding in Calais to help French authorities grapple with a flood of migrants trying to cross the English Channel to Britain. French and British officers will run the new command center, and cameras, fencing, floodlights, and infrared detection will be increased substantially to deter migrants trying to cross, including those risking the dangerous journey through the Channel Tunnel. Lisa Bryant, Paris.
Macedonia declared a state of emergency Thursday and will send troops to its border with Greece to stop illegal migrants from pouring into the country. The move stranded about 1,500 men, women, and children in a no-man's land between the two countries in the dangerously high summer heat. Around 2,000 migrants a day have been crossing. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, August 21st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Burundian President Nkurunziza will form a more inclusive government now that he has been inaugurated for a third term.
The current constitution does not allow parties that have less than 5% to be part of the cabinet. But with the revision, those that have less than 5% will be able to be part of the cabinet.
Alain Nyamitwe is Burundi's foreign minister. Zimbabwe's parliament passes workers' protection law. Nigerians fear flooding in anticipation of above-average rainfall this year. Sierra Leoneans look forward to the end of Ebola, but with caution. And the U.S. condemns the killing of a South Sudanese journalist.
The United States is committed to supporting freedom of expression, including of the press. Space for media, civil society organizations, and independent voices and views are crucial to building democracy and peace.
That's State Department spokesperson John Kirby. We'll have a report from Juba on the killing of journalist Moi Peter Julius. A green energy initiative in Kenya powers a community, and Somali refugees flee war-torn Yemen. Those stories, plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Burundi's foreign minister says President Pierre Nkurunziza is ready to form a more inclusive unity government now that he has been inaugurated for a third term. The opposition has condemned the third term as unconstitutional. At his unannounced inauguration on Thursday, President Nkurunziza said he would review Article 129 of the Constitution, which excludes parties with less than 5% of the national vote from being part of a national unity government. Foreign Minister Alain Nyamitwe said the revision would give representation to all Burundians. He also said President Nkurunziza pledged in his inaugural speech to unite all Burundians while at the same time vowing to protect the nation with the help of God.
The president made a speech today as he was accepting the office of president for this term of 2015-2020, in which he also pledged for uniting or bringing together all the Burundians, but also insisting on issues of security for all, enforcing the institutions of the Republic and the Constitution. Those were three main items of his statement.
The president said that the victory he won was achieved as a victory of all Burundians. What do you say to those who say his election was unconstitutional?
Well, I can say that it is their opinion. They are entitled to a different opinion, but they cannot impose their opinion on the majority of the people who voted for President Nkurunziza.
He made kind of a warning or a threat to those he think are taking the path that leads nowhere and who attack and fight their country, that they will be stopped by the hand of God. Is it God that's going to work, or he's going to use the security forces?
Look, our president is a believer, a strong Christian believer. And so am I, by the way. So there's nothing wrong in believing that God will protect our nation. Your nation, the United States of America, has had as its creed that it is a nation under God. In God we trust. What's wrong with us believing that God will protect our nation, which is actually true?
Mr. Foreign Minister, we understand there were no foreign leaders at the inauguration. Is this a sign that President Nkurunziza is going to have a difficult time trying to convince, say, the rest of Africa and the international community that he is legitimate?
James, may recall your own words. He was sworn in as president of the Republic of Burundi, all right? He'll govern over the people of Burundi. The elections were held in Burundi by Burundians for Burundi. Now, there might be many reasons why you have so many leaders, one of which being the change of the date of the inauguration, but that does not mean there's no legitimacy in President Nkurunziza being president for the 2015-2020 term. That does not mean at all. So I don't think it is a big deal, really. The thing is, the ceremony was held according to the Constitution of the Republic of Burundi.
The last time we spoke, you mentioned that the president was open and ready to form a government of national unity. Is that still on course? And what do you make of what the president had to say, that he will review possible changes to a key clause in the Constitution to allow the formation of a unity government?
The current Constitution does not allow parties that have less than 5% to be part of the cabinet. But with the revision, those that have less than 5% will be able to be part of the cabinet, which means basically that in a few months' time from now, after the revision, there will be a reshuffle of cabinet to incorporate those people, and then enlarging even the cabinet beyond what would possibly be if we consider the constitution as it stands today.
So that means the government is going to be truly representative, it's going to be inclusive.
No, it is already inclusive, but it will be more inclusive, if you like.
Alain Nyamitwe is Burundi's foreign minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Bujumbura. The United States says it is committed to supporting freedom of expression, including of the press, in South Sudan. This comes after a South Sudanese journalist was killed Thursday in the capital, Juba. The killing of Moi Peter Julius came after President Salva Kiir earlier this week threatened to kill journalists who reported against the country. State Department spokesperson John Kirby says the U.S. wants President Kiir to disavow his comments regarding journalists and for the South Sudanese government to expeditiously investigate the death of Julius.
We've seen those reports of the killing of South Sudanese journalist Peter Julius Moi, and we're very concerned about this development. Our embassy in Juba is following this situation very closely. Our condolences, of course, go out to his family, friends, and media colleagues. We call on the South Sudanese authorities and security services to expeditiously and thoroughly investigate this incident. We do not want to speculate on the nature of the incident or on any connections there may be to other matters. Separate and distinct, we are obviously deeply concerned by President Kiir's comments regarding journalists earlier this week, and we call on him to disavow those words. The United States is committed to supporting freedom of expression, including of the press. Space for media, civil society organizations, and independent voices and views are crucial to building democracy and peace.
That was State Department spokesperson John Kirby speaking at Thursday's Daily Press Briefing in Washington. South Sudanese journalist Moi Peter Julius, who was killed Wednesday night this week in Juba, was a political reporter for the corporate newspaper. He is the seventh journalist to be killed in South Sudan this year. As VOA fellow Tito Justin reports, the journalist's body was found in a residential neighborhood in Juba after being shot several times.
Relatives of Peter mourn the loss of their son at Juba Teaching Hospital. The body of the 27-year-old reporter was taken to the hospital after being found in Korok, a residential area located southwest of Juba town. Peter had been shot several times, including in the back and leg. Police say his personal possessions, including his phone, identification papers, and money, were not taken. Julius Kilong is the father of the slain reporter. He was at work when he got a call to say that his son had been shot dead.
I was for night shift. So I worked my night shift up to morning. And then I received a call that my son, Moi, has been shot dead. We got him, he has been shot just behind here. Then he fell.
Peter was murdered just 3 days after President Kiir said any journalist who works against the interest of South Sudan will be killed.
The freedom of press does not mean that you work against your country. And if anybody among them does not know that this country has killed people, we will demonstrate it one day on them.
The editor of the corporate newspaper, Ejulu Dani, says Peter interviewed the director of the Center of Peace and Development Studies at the University of Juba before he was killed.
That was one of the assignments that given him. He was going to interview Dr. Luka Byong on the issues concerning the economy. He told me he would not return, and he went. That was the last time I saw him. So the next day, I was expecting to see him this morning, only for other colleagues to call me and inform me that he was shot dead.
Peter is the seventh journalist to be killed this year in South Sudan. Five journalists died in a roadside ambush in western Baragazal in January, and another journalist was killed in Jonglei State in May. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Washington.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I am James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, August 21st. Please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. Zimbabwe's parliament yesterday passed a new labor law despite calls by the opposition, employers and workers to have it amended. Sebastian Mofu reports from Harare.
Zimbabwe's opposition legislators walked out of parliament Thursday in protest after Labour Minister Prisca Mfumira refused to incorporate their proposed amendments to a new labour law. The opposition and employers said the new law, which awaits President Robert Mugabe's signature, will further scare investors away from Zimbabwe by making labour very expensive. Workers say the new law gives too much power to the government to control unions. Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions Secretary General Javed Moyo says the unions were not consulted about the law.
Our concern is that government has decided not to involve other social partners. This was supposed to be done through the tripartite negotiating forum.
The tripartite negotiating forum Moyo refers to is made up of the government, employers and workers. But dismissing the opposition, Labour Minister Mfumira said Zimbabwe's labour rules needed urgent attention. Last month, the country's Supreme Court ruled that employers are allowed to fire workers with no severance as long as they give 3 months' notice. Since then, several companies, including some state-owned, have terminated workers and left them empty-handed. The Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions says more than 20,000 workers have been affected. The new law says an employer can only terminate a contract by mutual agreement or if the employee has been found guilty of misconduct. Otherwise, workers who are dismissed receive 2 weeks' pay for every year they were employed. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Sierra Leone is down to its last case of Ebola, but the country's highest-ranking official in charge of curtailing the disease is warning against complacency. Reporter Kelvin Lewis has details from Freetown.
The chief executive officer of the National Ebola Response Center in Sierra Leone, retired Major Paulo Conte, has told journalists that the end may be in sight for Ebola in Sierra Leone. He says only one person remains afflicted with the disease.
It's difficult to fix a precise date, but I'm hopeful that with the one case that we are told is responding to treatment, that if she tests negative and then another 72 hours, a second test is done, if she's again negative, then she will be discharged. If nothing happens, then the countdown to 42 starts.
The Ebola Response Chief Executive says the one case remaining in the Ebola treatment unit does not mean the fight against the disease is over.
I think we are winning, but we haven't won yet because we still have a patient at the ETU in Makeni. We still have people who are under quarantine. So the risk is still there, but generally we're doing well because I am looking at 6, 8, 9 months ago when we were registering 500, 550 cases. So we're doing relatively well. But the message is no complacency. We have to do the right things, make sure we wash our hands, temperatures are taken, and so on. If we continue at this rate, people call 117 when their family members are ill. People call 117 when somebody dies. If we continue on that road, then we'll see the end very soon.
Last week, President Kuruma symbolically ended the last major quarantine, releasing 595 people in the village of Mesesebe. There are now only 2 quarantine centers which may finish their 21-day monitoring period by next week. Retired Major Paulo Conte says he is cautiously optimistic that September could be the end of the road for Ebola in Sierra Leone. For VOA Africa, I'm Kelvin Lewis reporting from the capital, Freetown.
Farmers and residents of flood-prone areas in Nigeria are bracing for above-average precipitation in parts of the country this rainy season. Chris Stein reports from Lagos.
The annual rainy season is underway in Nigeria, and with that has come flooding. Local media report houses are being swept away and people forced to leave their farmlands in several states. Nigeria Meteorological Agency Director Anthony Anuforo says parts of the country are expecting above-average rainfall, particularly the northwestern states of Katsina and Sokoto. He says those states are especially flood-prone because that is where the Niger River enters the country. But Anuforo says there is more to the flooding than just rainfall. Cameroon says it may release water from the Lagdo Dam, which drains into Nigeria.
So if they do open the dam, of course it will increase the chances of having flooding.
Opening the dam in 2012 exacerbated floods that killed hundreds and displaced millions of Nigerians. Anuforo said cities are at risk due to flooding because many people have built along waterways or blocked drainages.
If you build on normal waterways, when the flood comes, it will certainly flood whatever area the settlement is.
Bauchi State Agricultural Development Program head, Ilyasu Aliu Gitol, says flooding there has forced some farmers off their land, in part because the rainfall has nowhere to go.
Most of our streams, our rivulets and rivers are filled up with sand. They are not deep enough to contain the rainfall that runs into the rivers.
The rainy season started late this year, Anuforo says, disrupting the planting season and causing some farmers to complain of crop losses. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
In 2013, U.S. President Barack Obama launched the multi-year Power Africa initiative to increase the availability of electricity in Africa, where millions don't have access to reliable power. Lenny Ruvaga in Kenya reports on one initiative on the outskirts of Nairobi that is converting human waste into electricity.
This is Mukuru Kwanjengo, a slum of about 100,000 people on the outskirts of Nairobi. Most of its residents do not have electricity. Those who do are illegally connected. Amos Nguru is the brains behind an innovation that generates electricity from human waste. 2 years ago, Nguru received a Power Africa grant funded by General Electric and the United States African Development Foundation. The gas generator produces 15 kilowatts of electricity, enough to power the nearby school and serve the local community. Nguru says the project helps meet the needs of the community.
Mukuru Kwajenga has power challenges, going by the fact that they have a lot of illegal connections, so power keeps on going on and off. And then they also have a sanitation problem.
The Mukuru Kwajenga Primary School, with about 2,000 students, now gets its electricity from Nguru's project after disconnecting from the old power source. School administrator Deborah Mwandengina says there were too many illegal connections to the school's power supply, which incurred bills the school was unable to foot.
We've been having challenges with the slums, and time and again they hack our power systems and they disconnect illegally to their homes, and we've been having such challenges. So we just decided we cannot live without electricity. It can't do us any good. So we decided to disconnect.
Student Doreen Kemunto, who lives in the slum, is glad her school has access to clean energy. Her mother says darkness no longer limits Doreen's studies.
Before the electricity was there, our children would not be able to learn since they could not come to school that early and leave at least because the school was very dark and they could not be able to learn.
According to the World Bank, only 23% of Kenya's population has access to electricity. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
Somali refugees who fled their country for Yemen to escape war and poverty are facing similar turmoil in their adoptive country and now want to return to their homeland. About 30,000 have been able to return to Somalia, some with the help of the Somali business community. Abdulaziz Bello was in Yemen recently and has this report.
This abandoned university in the port town of Mukalla has become home to thousands of Somali refugees and displaced Yemenis caught up in the conflict that has engulfed Yemen since early this year. Nurto, a mother of seven, has been living in Yemen for more than 12 years. She says she can no longer care for her children and wants to return to her native Somalia.
Since the fighting started, there's absolutely no way I could work. Everyone's on the run. Us, the Arabs, the United Nations. There was no one left to help us. We waited, hoping things will cool down, but it seems nothing changed. So we've decided to return to Somalia, whether we live or die.
Houthi rebels have been fighting the government in Yemen for nearly a year. However, Saudi Arabia and other Arab nations have launched airstrikes against the rebels, ousting them from a string of towns in southern Yemen. Mohammed Abdullahi, a Somali fisherman and a father of six, fled with his family from the port town of Aden. He is among the thousands who were trapped in the fighting.
I was a fisherman when I was living in Aden. I earned a living for my family through fishing. But once the fighting commenced, there was absolutely no way I could continue working. Me and my family were trapped in Aden for more than 3 months.
A ship sent by Somalia's business community with the help of international aid agencies brings back more than 2,500 Somalis. They boarded the ship for a 30-hour voyage from Mukalla to the Somali town of Bosaso. Most were women, young children, and the elderly. In Somalia at last, their hope is that the federal government will resettle them and guarantee their security so they can build a better life in coming years. Abdulaziz Bilo for VOA News, Bosaso.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Awoma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with basketball. Defending champions Angola beat Mozambique 84-72 at the Africa Men's Basketball Championships in Tunis on Thursday. Senegal edged Morocco 76-71. Cape Verde Islands dismissed Ivory Coast 76-56. And Algeria outplayed Zimbabwe 87-67. Today, Friday, Uganda challenged Nigeria. Tunisia faced Central African Republic. Gabon play Mali. And Egypt engage Cameroon. In athletics, Ugandan defending champion Stephen Kiprotich seeks to retain his marathon title in the first event at the IWF World Athletics Championships, which starts in Beijing, China, tomorrow Saturday. His main challengers are Ethiopian Lelisa Desisa, a silver medalist at the last World Championships, Kenya's Olympic silver medalist Wilson Kipsang, and world record holder Dennis Kimeto. Staying in Beijing, South Africa's Stephen Mokoka aims for a better result in his third consecutive 10,000 meters at the World Championships today, Friday. He gives an insight into his frame of mind.
If you could look at the history of me in terms of World Championships, I come from Daegu. I got one lap, and then 2 years later I went to Moscow. I was in the race. I could manage to stay with the guys till the last 8 kilometers. That's when they moved away from me, but when I finished, they were like 150 meters to go away from me. I'm hoping to improve on that, because the only way is I always take myself as my own opponent, and then I always look at my level. So for me, I'm not even going to be a factor on the race. The most important thing is to see whether I'm developing, and then I'm improving as much as I can. For me to finish, I'm like on the home straight with the guys. It will be a great achievement for me. I mean, to look at the history where I started in terms of track and field. So my main goal is to see improving from my previous competition in terms of championships.
That was Stephen Mokoka, the South African 10,000 meter champion, speaking in Beijing, China. Turning to football, in an all-Algerian encounter, USM Algiers challenged defending champions Ntan Setif in the Orange Africa Champions League in Algiers today, Friday. Tomorrow, Saturday, Algeria's Mouloudia El Ulma hosts Sudan's El Merrek. On Sunday, Sudan's El Hilal face the Democratic Republic of Congo's TP Mazembe as Morocco's Maghreb Tetouan host Egypt's Smouha. Elsewhere, South Africa's Orlando Pirates welcome the Republic of Congo's AC Leopards to Soweto as Tunisia's Esperance host Egyptian defending champions El Ahly in Orange African Confederations Cup tomorrow, Saturday. On Sunday, Mali's Stade Malien face Tunisian visitors Etoile du Sahel as Tunisia's CS Faxian engage Egypt's Zamalek. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Omer in Johannesburg, South Africa. Wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good weekend, and we'll see you again on Monday morning. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Burundi's President Pierre Nkurunziza was sworn in for a third term on Thursday, but remains under fire from critics who say he is breaking term limits in the constitution. The U.S. State Department said the inauguration shows the ruling party's intent to ignore the voices of its people in pursuit of its own political agenda. That is it for this Friday, August 21st edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer David Vendi, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Oman, I'm James Barton in Washington, saying have a good day.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want, download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me every weekday evening for Africa News Tonight from the Voice of America. It's a thorough summary of the day's events, featuring interviews with the people making news in Africa. You'll hear every side of an issue. And of course, Sunny Young drops by with the sunny side of sports. Plus, we have special features on science, business, Africans abroad, and comments from listeners like you. So please join me every weekday for Africa News Tonight from the Voice of America.
It is Friday.